If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Hello and welcome to the BBC History Magazine Weekly Podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove, the editor of the magazine, and this is the third of our October 2011 editions. Don't forget, BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit our website, historyextra.com, for more information, or why not follow us at Twitter, twitter.com/historyextra, or Facebook, facebook.com/historyextra. Now, coming up, we have...
We were jolly lucky that in a sort of backhanded way, we sort of had Hitler on our side.
That was Sir Max Hastings on the Second World War.
It was unpleasant. I mean, a big debate is just how unpleasant was it?
That was Justin Meggett on the experiences of those captured by North African pirates in the 17th century. For our first interview this week, the magazine's deputy editor, Rob Attar, spoke with Sir Max Hastings. As a military historian, Max has been writing books about the Second World War for over 30 years. His new history of the conflict, All Hell Let Loose, has just been published, and he explained why there is still a great deal to say about this global conflagration.
Obviously, many books have been written about the Second World War. What more is there to say, do you think?
I never stopped being amazed. When I first started writing books about the Second World War back in 1979, I would never have guessed that in the 21st century I'd still be doing it, or that there'd still be an audience. But my gosh, there is this enormous audience. And one of the reasons is because there's always more to say. And I never stopped being amazed. Here have I been researching this period for 35 years, and one keeps being amazed by the things you find out. I mean, for this book, to take some small things, researching the Syrian campaign and hearing of the French air ace Pierre Legrand, who became an ace by shooting down 7 Hurricanes over Syria in 1941. And most people don't realise that, certainly until 1944, the French fought against us, and even against the Americans, a good deal more energetically, as Churchill complained, than they had against the Germans in 1940. The Madagascar campaign, when we landed in Madagascar to preempt a Japanese landing, and again, the Vichy French fought against us tooth and nail, and came across a signal from a French submarine commander complaining that he'd been told to go off to the French colony of Dakar, and he was furious at having to leave without having had a chance to sink a British warship. Perspectives on the war. Everybody now knows, as they didn't a generation ago, that the Russian front was important. But people are still amazed when you tell them that more than 90% of the German army's casualties in World War II happened on the Eastern Front. And the Russians incurred the overwhelming majority. It was 65% of all Allied military casualties in the war were Russians. How many were British and how many were American? 2% each. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that what we did wasn't important or whatever, but it just gives a sense of the perspective. I always enjoy counterfactuals. One of my favourite ones, which I put in this book, is about the Battle of Britain. That it was extraordinary that Hitler, having achieved this dazzling triumph in the summer of 1940, then went on and made the second biggest mistake of the war. The first biggest was obviously invading Russia, but the second biggest was to launch the Battle of Britain, to launch the Luftwaffe attack against Britain, which was almost the only sort of battle that the British at that stage were really well equipped to fight. We had fighter command with the most sophisticated fighter direction system in the world, matched to radar, and we had the fleet, which was actually in many ways more important than fighter command for deterring the Germans from launching an invasion. Now, I personally believe, and I've said in the book, that if instead of launching the Luftwaffe, Hitler had simply gone off and left us to stew, if he'd sent even small forces to the Mediterranean, captured Gibraltar, captured Malta, thrown us out of the Middle East, got to Cairo, which he easily could have done at the end of 1940, 1941, then I think it would have been very difficult for Churchill's government to survive, very difficult to resist the appeasers who would have been demanding peace negotiations with the Germans. Because what you have to remember is in 1939, everybody was terrified of an absolutely annihilating air attack on Britain. Mm-hmm. Now, if Hitler hadn't sent the Luftwaffe, then people would have gone on being terrified of it. But as it happened, what they discovered was that although the Blitz was horrible, it wasn't nearly as bad as everybody thought. That all those statistics of hundreds of thousands of dead from an air attack, they found that, yes, there were thousands of dead, but you could put up with it. You could carry on producing in the factories. Life could go on. So Hitler exposed himself to defeat at British hands in 1940, whereas he had another much, much better option, which is just to leave us to sweat.
So you think realistically the Germans could have easily won the war, 1940, 1941?
I don't think you can ever say that the Germans could easily have won the war, but it would have been a much more attractive option. I think they could have probably knocked Britain out of the war. What one always has to remember is most of the British ruling class didn't like Churchill and thought that he was wrong to keep the war going. They thought it was absolutely hopeless. They thought we had no chance of beating Hitler. That a lot of the members of his own government, including Chamberlain and Halifax in the late summer and autumn of 1944, they really thought that peace was the best option. Now, as long as Churchill was there, they couldn't say that, they couldn't do anything about it. But I think Churchill's position would probably have become untenable if it hadn't been for the Battle of Britain, and if we had been thrown out of the Mediterranean. And that, I think, then things would have got more interesting. Then, of course, there'd have been the huge question. If Hitler had then invaded Russia, what might have happened? Could he have won an overwhelming victory? He might have done.
Hmm. And you say about throwing Britain out of the Mediterranean. Would the Royal Navy, do you not think, have been able to prevent that from happening?
The Royal Navy could have done very little in the Mediterranean when the Germans held all the air bases around it. That the Royal Navy clung to footholds on Malta and at Alexandria, but it would have been somewhere between difficult and impossible for the Royal Navy to hold on against a really devastating German assault if the Luftwaffe had really gone down there in strength. I mean, the Royal Navy, as it was, suffered terrible casualties in the Mediterranean in 1940-41. So, in many ways, what Hitler did after June 1940 was what suited Churchill best.
So do you think part of what you're doing with this book is attempting to correct popular misconceptions?
I'm always trying very hard at this stage to put a global perspective on everything, in that I focused a tremendous amount in this book on the experience of Poles and Yugoslavs and, of course, Russians, because we are very prone, my generation were brought up to see the war in very British terms. Of course, we all grew up with the Dam Busters and Reach for the Sky, and all this is true and important, and it's in my book. But one has to see this against the background of what was happening against the world. That there's the British lose 450,000 dead in the war, which God knows was enough. But there's the Chinese, who nobody ever thinks of the Chinese being in the war, but 15 million Chinese died in the war. That's a story that that most people ought to want to know more about. The story of India, that there you had 400 million Indians, not many of whom really felt the slightest loyalty to Britain. Britain had to keep more battalions doing internal security duties in India to effectively hold down the Indian population than it could deploy against the Japanese for most of the war. And then, of course, there was the dreadful business of the Bengal famine in 1943, when, because the Japanese had captured Burma, from which most of Bengal's rice usually came, when a cyclone came and when they had a bad harvest and so on, suddenly Bengal finds itself starving. And the Viceroy of India appeals to London. And he says to Churchill, we've got to have shipping to bring supplies. And Churchill says, no. He amazed the Viceroy, and he amazed most of the people, the Secretary of State for India, Leo Amery. He was appalled. But Churchill took a very tough line. I think it was probably one of his worst decisions of the war. Churchill said the Indian people have just got to fend for themselves, that they've got to learn to put up and shut up. He said, we need all the shipping we got for amphibious operations in the Mediterranean, and then, of course, Normandy and so on. We can't spare shipping to send a lot of food to the Indians, whom he hated. He didn't like the Indians at all. He thought they were disloyal, treacherous, wretched people. And the result was that at least 1 million, and some modern Indian historians think as many as 3 million people died, while in the clubs of Calcutta, white sahibs were eating unlimited bacon and eggs. And it's not a pretty story. And I hasten to say, none of this changes one's... We always have to keep in mind the fact, of course, our side deserved to win. And I'm not for a moment suggesting, oh, we were as bad as the Germans, or yeah, we were... There's no doubt the Allies were the good guys. But we also have to be aware that the story was a bit more complicated. They weren't entirely the good guys. Very few times in history are people entirely the good guys, or for that matter, entirely the bad guys. So these are stories that deserve to be told, and also, of course, there are some stories of heroism that people don't know. I never stop being amazed by... I was terribly moved reading about the Arctic convoys, which I thought I knew quite a lot about, but so many stories of the Royal Navy's convoys to the Arctic, in which they suffered such terrible losses, are not well known. There was one about an engineering officer who, when his ship, I think it was the cruiser Trinidad, was sinking, and all his stokers were trapped below. And this man, who was up on the upper deck, he said, I'm not going to leave my men. And he was last seen going down below to join his stokers and go to the bottom of the Arctic with them. And that sort of story, even after all these years I've been writing about these things, one is so moved by these stories. And damn it, although we all think we know the story of the Dam Busters, that too remains, and I devoted several pages to that story because it is so extraordinary. It was the greatest precision bombing feat of the war, and all the debunkers and detractors in the world have not been able to knock any holes in that. That what Guy Gibson and 617 Squadron did was quite extraordinary. And again and again, you find that heroic stories aren't quite what they were made out to be. But in this case, that story really was everything it was made out to be.
So it was actually lived up to the legend, the reality.
The only thing, if you want to nitpick a bit, what you have to say, the economic achievement was quite limited because the trouble was everybody was told afterwards that the Mona and the Ada dams, which were destroyed, were the vital targets. But actually, RAF economic intelligence knew perfectly well that the Sorpe Dam was the key one, that the Sorpe, if they'd been able to blow the Sorpe as well, then they could have had a devastating effect on raw steel production. But as it was, the Sorpe was an earth dam, which wasn't as susceptible. as the Mona and the Ada to Barnes Wallis's bouncing bombs. So they failed against the Sulpi, and the German steel production wasn't much affected. The main effect was that before that, the Germans hadn't bothered much about defending reservoirs and dams. But after that, they had to waste a lot of resources for the rest of the war defending their dams. So it certainly wasn't a waste of time. And the moral effect was terrific. I mean, the news of the Dam Busters raid swept around the world. And British people, what one wishes to remember about the war, it went on such a long time, and it was such a grim, dreary, gloomy experience for most people who weren't at the glamorous end of it, who weren't flying Spitfires, who weren't commanding destroyers, that for most people it was just unbelievably dreary and miserable, and it was about separations and loneliness and so on. And so these little rays of hope, these sudden little flashes of sunshine, were hugely important to people. And the Dams raid was one of the foremost of these. But it is what I've tried to do in this book, more than anything. In other books, I've written about the big people and the warlords and Stalin and Churchill and Hitler and Roosevelt and so on. In this book, it's overwhelmingly about to try and answer the question, what was the war like? And of course, it meant very different things to different people. And I've tried to explain what it was like for a British housewife, or for that matter, an American housewife, and for a Chinese peasant, and for a Russian infantryman. And it was very different things for all these. And most people, I mean, for example, you find lots of diaries of English women complaining about how dreary rations were. And there's a very vivid and funny account of a small boy who remembered his father at the breakfast table saying to his mother one morning, "What is this disgusting thing you put on the table?" And she said, "It's carrot marmalade." And he got up from the table and he picked up the jar and carried it outside and threw it on the compost heap. And yet, carrot marmalade, if you were a prisoner in Changi jail with the Japanese, or if you were in besieged Leningrad, would have been a delicacy beyond price. People in Britain, everybody's heard of Stalingrad these days. Far fewer people know about the siege of Leningrad. At least 800,000 people starved to death in Leningrad. The siege of Leningrad went on at its worst for 2 years and altogether about 3 years. And people ate each other. Cannibalism became rife in Leningrad because there was nothing else. People were being murdered in the streets, not for their property. Their money was no use to anybody, but for their flesh. And if you contrast, I mean, I've always argued in all my books that I believe you needed people as tough and ruthless as the Russians to be able to defeat the ruthlessness of Hitler. I don't think we could have done it. I think that supposing Coventry had been besieged, or Birmingham, and the people of Coventry or Birmingham had been asked, well, are you willing to keep this siege going even if it means eating each other? Well, of course they wouldn't have been. They just said, well, maybe Nazi rule won't be that bad. That's what they'd have said. And you needed, I think one of Hitler's huge miscalculations, which I've written about in the book, he despised the Russians. He thought Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia, was going to be easy. Because after beating Britain and France, supposedly the most powerful and sophisticated nations in Western Europe, he thought that dealing with the savages of Russia would be a doddle. What he never took into account was that it might be more difficult to defeat a people inured to suffering and hardship and brutality than to defeat the people of democracies in whom moderation and respect for human life were thought to be virtues. I mean, we have to remember Stalin's commissars shot something over 200,000 of their own people. Maybe as many as 300,000 of their own people in the course of the war for alleged desertion or cowardice or whatever. And somehow, when you have to accept, this was a very powerful force in keeping the Red Army fighting. That why did they fight like tigers at Stalingrad? Partly, yes, they were jolly brave, but also because they knew jolly well that if they didn't, they were going to be shot. And that was not true in the British Army. The British Army knew that if you ran away, everybody might be terribly cross with you, but in the end, they give you some bacon and eggs and find you another uniform and maybe let you fight another day. Now, that was very nice and very humane, but it didn't help a lot when it came to defeating the Nazis.
So it seems like perhaps British suffering, although bad, was really nothing compared to what Russia went through, or the Soviet Union in the war.
Our experience is nobody, it would be impertinent for anyone of our generation who didn't live through the war, to suggest that one has to remember the war was horrible for everybody. This is very important. There were a very small number of adventurers who really had a good time in the war, but for most people it was a horrible, horrible experience, especially for women. Partly, although some of them it gave terrific opportunities to, and I've written about this at length, because women often don't get enough attention in books about the war. But yes, some women were empowered by the war. They had responsibilities and opportunities they hadn't had before. But one of the principal defining characteristics of the war is it exposed women all over the world to sexual exploitation on an unprecedented scale in a world that was arbitrated by force. It was a ghastly, ghastly experience. All I'm really saying is not that, oh, it wasn't that bad for the British. I'm saying it wasn't as bad for the British as it was for the Russians and the Chinese. But, oh gosh, you've only got to read the diaries of people. I mean, the separations, the loneliness of, even if nothing happened to one of your family, to find your husband taken away from you for 3-4 years, your young children growing up not knowing their father. Often when their father did return, it took years for a family to readjust to learning to know each other again. And so there was that aching loneliness. And then, of course, in a lot of cases, women especially, but also men, when they had the opportunity, would find consolation with other people somewhere else. And then there was that ghastly guilt. And children, too. Again, some children managed to quite enjoy the war, but for most it was terrible beyond belief. And again, I go back to the siege of Leningrad, that by far the biggest rations were given, and the rations were pretty miserable, to workers who were capable of working. Stalin's Russia was absolutely ruthless about giving absolutely minimal rations to those who couldn't work, which meant the very young and the very old. So babies and old people died in hugely disproportionate numbers there, and it was unspeakably cruel. And again and again and again, in accounts and diaries and letters, you come across these horrific stories of what happened to very, very young people, innocents. And at every level, even in Britain, that yes, a few of them may have enjoyed it, but for most it was a ghastly experience.
I mean, did you find it quite difficult to contain the whole conflict in one book, especially with trying to get all these perspectives in the book?
Nobody can tell the whole story of the war in a single volume. And if you try, you're bound to fail, because this was the greatest event in human history. What any one writer can do is to produce their own personal take on the war. And what I've tried to do is, first of all, I haven't said much about things I've written about in earlier books. I devoted a whole chapter of Nemesis to writing about the dropping of the atomic bomb. So I haven't gone over my own arguments in that. What I've tried to do is pick out things that I feel I can tell people, things that may surprise them a little, and give them a perspective on the war that they hadn't seen before. And I was terribly pleased that a very famous historian, whom I greatly admire, whom I got to read the manuscript, and he said, "I really didn't believe, Max, when you started this, that you could produce any surprises, but you managed to produce an amazing number of surprises." And so I was awfully pleased that he said that, and I hope that that ordinary readers will find exactly the same. That it's a very personal account, but it has tried to major on the things that may surprise people a bit.
So does that mean you haven't, say, gone into huge depth on things that people know quite a lot about, say the Battle of Britain?
I haven't gone into it. There's no point. And I just, at every chapter, I said to myself, of course you have to keep the narrative framework to go from 1939 to 45. You have to give people the basic events. But at every turn, you try to give most space to the things that may surprise people and least space to the things they know. There's no point in going over all the detail of the Hitler bomb plot again, or for that matter, of the detail of the Battle of Alamein. In the same way, my maps in the book, I've left out of both the maps and the task all the numbers of armies and divisions and all that sort of thing, because this isn't supposed to be a military history. This is supposed to be a portrait of human experience. And I suppose the chapters, if anything, I'm most proud of in the book, I've written one chapter simply about what the experience of war, I think I call it living with war, in which I've just tried to write about what it meant to live through the war for different sorts of people. And another chapter I've written, headed Divided Loyalties, which is trying to explain that in almost every society, there were people, in some cases a lot of people, who just didn't agree with the view that their nation was taking, that about which side they were on. That I mean, America, one has to remember, in 1939, I think it was something like an opinion poll, showed that 20-something percent of Americans thought that if Americans wanted to join the Wehrmacht, they should be allowed to. In 1942, another opinion poll showed that something like 30-something percent of Americans believed that it would be perfectly okay to make a separate peace with Germany. They didn't feel that hostile. They hated the Japanese because of Pearl Harbor, but they didn't hate the Germans in the same way. Canadians, French Canadians, were very against the war. You know, French, there are a lot of French Canadians. And, you know, I came across an RAF pilot's diary who passed through Quebec, and he said some of his mates got beaten up by French Canadians who bitterly resented the fact that Canada was in the war. And, of course, one has to remember, neither Canada nor Australia ever dared, or Australia did at the very end, to introduce compulsory overseas service, conscription for overseas war service, because it would have been too unpopular. And quite a lot of Australians and quite a lot of Canadians chose to stay at home. Some went abroad and fought very bravely, but there were also an awful lot who said, thanks, but no thanks, I'll do my military service back home. France, I've already said something about how incredibly divided France were. One has to remember the basic statistic. Substantially more French people carried arms for Vichy security forces or for the Germans than ever did for the Allies or joined the resistance or anything else. But France was a bitterly divided society, and there were a lot of divisions. South Africa, for example, one has to remember one future South African prime minister had to be interned because he was a Nazi sympathizer. A lot of Afrikaners were violently against South Africa being in the war on the Allied side. Of course, Jan Smuts, Churchill's close friend, had brought South Africa in, but there were bitter divisions. There were riots in Johannesburg at one point against the war, I think in 1940. So, again and again, what you find is there are all sorts of nuances about people's attitudes to all this. Even the Poles, the Poles were the great victims of the war. Terrifying to think 5 million Poles died in the war, admittedly a lot of them Jews. But when the Poles first came over to Britain, they were heroes, and they were treated as heroes, and the Poles made a wonderful contribution to the Allied war effort. But then this great tragedy, as the war went on, the British people became obsessively enthusiastic about the Russians because they knew the Russians were fighting so hard. And so when the Russians turned against the Poles, so did a lot of British people. And it's really depressing to read in Polish diaries to find that British people were being, a lot of British people were being pretty horrid to Poles in Britain, even ones wearing British uniform in 1944-45, because they accused them of just being troublemakers who were upsetting the Russians, whereas all these Poles wanted was to live in a free, non-communist Poland at the end of the war. And Poland, it was the great tragedy that here were all these Poles who'd fought in arguably more heroically than any other nation against the Nazis, and whom a couple of hundred thousand accepted exile, far more than Frenchmen did, in order to come and fight with us. And yet at the end of the war, most of those people had to stay as permanent exiles in the West, because if they went back to Poland, they were killed.
Do you feel this kind of side of the war isn't as well known because it's just a bit unpalatable now? People don't want to think about British people misbehaving or about the French being on the German side. And
I don't think an awful lot of the things I'm talking about are not great secrets. They're just, the war was such a big event that inevitably we tend to focus on things that we like and we find cosy and convenient. And yeah, we all like Reach for the Sky and Kenneth Moore in his Hurricane and all the rest of it. That's terrific fun. And it just now, it seems to me, that to justify writing and reading new books about the war at this stage, we have to be looking at new issues. What I've failed, if readers read this book and think, oh, well, we've been here before. And all the time, you've got to say to yourself, here I am doing something which is pretty cheeky, writing another book about the Second World War in the 21st century, that the only case for doing that is if you can draw people's attention to things they hadn't thought that much about before. And I never cease to be amazed by just how many things like that there are, which are absolutely fascinating. And all the cliches about wars are true, and especially about the Second World War, that the best people behave unbelievably well and the worst people behave unbelievably badly.
Do you think your book might ruffle a few feathers with some of the statements that have been made?
There's been a big change over my lifetime as a writer, in that when I started writing, an awful lot of veterans were still alive, and they fought very hard indeed to discourage another generation from, as they saw it, sullying their heritage, their reputation. They didn't want to really rethink the issues, and who can blame them? I guess we all... But now they're gone, it's easier to look more objectively at things. I was terribly struck 20 years ago when I wrote my book, Overlord, about the Normandy campaign, and I suggested there, which was then a sort of revolutionary idea, I said we have to face the fact the German army was the best army of the war by miles. And it was very striking. The correspondence I had, a lot of ordinary British soldiers, veterans, went bonkers. And veterans associations sent me rude letters, you know, round robins, saying, how dare you say that, the Tommy was the... But the officers, I was amazed at the letters, and I've kept them all. Officers who served in Normandy wrote me amazing letters describing their feelings and their attitude. And I think, without exception, all of them said, yes, we knew the Germans were much better than us, that we were only able to beat them because we had more of everything, especially air power and tanks and so on. And the sort of story which I've included in this book, following the publication of Overlord, very interesting man who later became a Tory MP called Anthony Kershaw, who'd been brigade major of an armoured brigade in Normandy. And he wrote saying just how good the Germans were, and they always realised that the Germans were fantastic. But he also said, it's terribly embarrassing to look back and remember how unkeen our chaps, he said, had fought in the desert for 2 or 3 years. And when they got home to England, they wanted to think that it was somebody else's turn and they wouldn't have to go and do D-Day. And he said, we nearly had a mutiny in one of the tank regiments, I think it was 3rd Royal Tanks, when he said they daubed their barracks with slogans, "No Second Front Now." And he said, if we hadn't put in a new commanding officer who managed to more or less persuade them to go and do it, he said, I really think we might have had an actual mutiny. Well, these are the sort of stories you didn't hear much about 20, 30 years ago. But nowadays, it doesn't change anything. It doesn't mean, I don't want anyone ever to think. I have enormous respect for the generation that did these things. And I always say in the introduction to all my books, that none of us must ever forget how privileged we all are that we haven't had to go through this. And really what's remarkable is how well our parents and grandparents did through these ghastly experiences. But it's not in any way diminishing them to try and look at these things in perspective and try and see things as they really were, rather than through a sort of rose-tinted specs.
It's no disgrace to say that they were fighting the best army in the world anyway. Surely that's an achievement in some ways.
They were... Well, actually, one of the important things I've said in my book, which I don't think some previous historians have quite focused on in the way that I have, is that there is almost a paradox that the German army fought its battles brilliantly well, and yet Nazi Germany fought the war unbelievably incompetently. That Nazi Germany and Hitler's regime got almost every big decision disastrously wrong. You've only got to think of the invasion of Russia and the handling of the U-boat campaign, which was also a shambles, not generally understood, and the Battle of Britain and all the rest of it and so on. And what was the great paradox about it all was, here was the German army, who on the battlefield were fantastically good, and you could generally reckon that in order to beat any German force, we had to have more of everything, and especially a lot more air power, to have a chance of beating any German force, even one smaller than us. And yet, fortunately for civilization and for the Allied cause in the war, that that again and again Hitler and the Nazi regime managed to undo the best efforts of the German army. I mean, heaven knows, if the German generals had just been left to do things their way, they might even have won in Russia. It was only because Hitler insisted on doing it his way and dividing the armies instead of the German army. The German generals wanted to go straight for Moscow and nothing else, but Hitler insisted on dividing the army for Barbarossa and so on. And the German generals knew the limits of what their country and their army could reasonably do, but Hitler didn't. So we were jolly lucky that in a sort of backhanded way, we sort of had Hitler on our side.
It's almost a bit like in the First World War when he blamed politicians for interfering with the army. In the Second World War, he did it himself.
Well, there was a huge difference, and I wrote about this in my last book, Finest Years, that extraordinary contrast, that although Churchill took a huge part in the military decisions, if the military advice on big issues was strongly against him, he would almost always defer to it. He complained, he shouted and screamed and sometimes burst into tears. But in the last resort, he would, on the big things, he would very seldom go against the professional advice of his generals and admirals and air marshals. Hitler wasn't like that at all. Again and again and again, that Hitler's senior military people would tell him to do or not do X or Y, and he would still go and do it. And this was absolutely disastrous. So you can make an endless list of all the things that if Hitler had done them differently, or not done them in some cases, then it's just possible the war might have had a different outcome. Although I think another important point, which I've also discussed in my book, another basic truth which isn't generally understood, because the Nazis did so brilliantly well in 1940-41, we tended to overrate them. In fact, Germany economically and industrially was not nearly as strong as we thought. But what's amazing is that the Germans managed to do as much as they did from a very weak industrial base. I mean, even in the middle of the Battle of Britain, the British were producing single-engine fighters faster than the Germans were. The Germans had nothing like the output of aircraft that we did, even in 1940, when we were relatively unprepared. And although later in the war they produced some things better than us, they went on producing better tanks than we did right to the end. But in most respects, you know, what's remarkable is just how weak the Germans were. And I hadn't realized till I was researching this book. Hitler's key economic and industrial advisors knew by December 1941, even before Pearl Harbor, that they couldn't win the war. Now, that didn't mean they'd resign themselves to losing it, but they were still hoping for a negotiated peace. They were still hoping to be able to put up enough of a fight to divide the Allies and persuade one side or the other to make a deal. But most histories of the war say, oh, well, November, December 1942 was the turning point, because that was when, first of all, of course, the Russians won the victory at Stalingrad. Yeah. We won El Alamein. The Germans, the Americans landed in North Africa. And in the Far East, the Japanese tide was rolled back. But I hadn't realized till I was researching this book that key informed people in Germany realized the gig was up much, much sooner than that. The moment the German army failed to get to Moscow in the first winter of the war, when it was thrown back from the gates of Moscow in December 1941, they knew that military victory in the war was now unattainable. And in fact, one or two of them had the courage to suggest to Hitler he should make peace. Of course, he didn't. But from that moment on, they knew that what they were fighting for was to try and force a negotiation, not to achieve absolute military victory. And I hadn't taken that aboard myself until I was writing this book.
That's fascinating. And so then, even had they won at Stalingrad, say, they couldn't really have won the war in the long run.
By that stage, once the Americans were in, from the moment the Americans were in, of course, the Germans were also completely underestimated, German economic power. American economic power. It's very hard to see. Of course, they could have kept the war going a long time, but Germany was so stretched and in such desperate straits economically. And, of course, one of the most... Actually, one thing I've written a lot about in the book, which I think is terribly interesting, is food. Food was absolutely pivotal to every aspect of the war. That One of the fundamental reasons that Hitler invaded Russia was because he wanted the corn of the Ukraine. And one of the things that's most terrifying is when you read the documents that the Germans deliberately planned when they invaded Russia, that they made a calculation by which they reckoned somewhere between 5 and 7 million Ukrainians would starve because they were going to ship their grain, their corn to Germany to feed the German people. And the ruthlessness with which Hitler pillaged all the occupied nations to feed his own people, the Japanese did the same too. The curious result was that nobody in Germany was ever hungry until the end of the war. Once they lost the war, May 1945, the rest of 1945, a lot of Germans were nearly starving. But up to the day they lost the war, they'd had a pretty cushy war food-wise. Whereas the French and the Belgians had been very short of food. Mm. And French children born in the 1940s, early 1940s, were, I think, several centimetres shorter than their counterparts born 10 years earlier. Because, these children, there were a lot of children with symptoms of rickets in Belgium and so on and so forth, that all these countries have been systematically pillaged to feed Germany. And the Japanese did just the same. And again, not many people know that something up to 5 million people died in Southeast Asia during the war, almost entirely as a result of deliberate Japanese policies that the Japanese ordered the Vietnamese, for example, first of all, to start sending all their rice to Japan, and secondly, to replant a lot of their rice areas with fiber crops for textiles that the Japanese wanted. And some old Vietnamese today, they say, and I hadn't realized this till I was writing this book either, they say the experience of 1943-44 was worse for them than the Vietnam War with the Americans a generation later. And when you look at those numbers, that at least a million Vietnamese died in that period, then you can understand why they feel that way. Yeah. So these are things, again, that I learned when I was writing the book, and I don't think many British readers know.
No, I didn't think they would, to be honest. Could I quickly ask you why you chose the name of the book, All Hell Let Loose?
I chose the title of the book because if you look at any memoir or account written by anybody who went through the Second World War, almost always somewhere they'll say, and then all hell broke loose. Hmm. And sometimes our generation attempted to dismiss that and say, oh, it's just a cliche, it's just the sort of thing that people say. But if you actually think about it, that for the people who lived through this, it was a very vivid statement of what they experienced, that there were all these people who'd grown up living peaceful, orderly lives in which they or their parents went out to work every morning and came back every night and had their tea at 5 o'clock and looked after the dog and tilled the garden and all the rest of it. And suddenly, in 1939, they were plunged into experiences which were like Dante's Inferno, which were like medieval visions of hell, in which they saw human beings ripped asunder, they saw whole communities and cities crushed to rubble, in which they saw people starving to death and dying in the most terrible fashions. And I think All Hell Broke Loose is a very vivid phrase to describe what the experience of the Second World War was like for a vast number of people. And that's why I've chosen it as my title.
And just one last question. So is this going to be your last word on the Second World War, do you think?
I feel at the moment that after writing this, I've tried to put into All Hell Let Loose all the things I've learnt over the last 35 years' research that I hadn't put into earlier books. But having done that, I try never to write books unless I think I've got something new to say, and I think that I've said my piece about the Second World War, and now I'm researching 1914, and which I'm producing a book called Centenary in 3 years' time, and I'm loving researching 1914 because it's fascinating, and it's wonderful to work on a new period, and again, I feel that surge of excitement. I think here's something I can tell people, or here's quite a lot of things that I don't think they know already about 1914. So the only thing that would ever make me write another book about the Second World War is if I came across something that I felt I could tell people they didn't know already. So I've loved working on this period for the last 35 years, and I've learned a huge amount, and I met extraordinary people. I've been deeply moved by their stories that they've told me or that I've read. But I feel that enough is enough, and this is signals a closure for me, and I hope the readers will find it a closure too.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
That was Sir Max Hastings. You can read more from him in our November issue. Now we have a short advertisement feature.
This month, Oxford University Press publishes a new biography of Heinrich Himmler. In the following clip, the author Peter Longerisch describes what it was like to put every aspect of the Nazi leader's personal life and political career under the microscope.
My name is Peter Longerisch. I completed a biography of Heinrich Himmler, and I have to say, to spend 6-7 years the person like this is not always a pleasure, and this is probably the reason why there are not too many biographies on this man, and I think I can say that my biography is the first comprehensive book on him, which makes full use of the material which came to light after the Eastern European archives opened 2 decades ago. Now, the person is a rather ordinary man on the one hand. On the other side, he seems to be a self-controlled person who lives behind a mask. And it's very difficult to find an approach to his personality. I think for a biography like this, you have to combine the traditional biographical method with the modern structural approach. You cannot explain Himmler and all what he did, you know, by looking at his childhood as youth. You have to look into the general history of the Nazi movement as it developed. The problem for a biographer is to explain how this rather unremarkable man could become the leader of such a powerful organization like the SS, and could become, towards the end of the Second World War, the second most powerful leader in the Third Reich.
Peter Longrisch's book, Heinrich Himmler, A Life, is published by Oxford University Press and is available through Amazon and in all good bookstores. For more information, visit www.oup.co.uk/Himmler.
Back to the interviews then. Next up is Dr. Justin Meggett, University Senior Lecturer in the Study of Religion and the Origins of Christianity at the University of Cambridge. And he's talking about the somewhat untold story of the slave trade in North Africa. Dr. Megger is discussing this subject at the Cambridge Festival of Ideas coming up soon. I talked to him to find out more about the subject. So you've been researching an aspect of slavery which perhaps we don't immediately think of. When someone mentions slavery in historic context, thoughts immediately turn to the trade in Africans being shipped to the Americas by Europeans. But you've been looking at another aspect of slavery, which is the enslavement of Britons and others who are captured by privateers based in North Africa. So can you give us a quick introduction to this? What period are we talking about? What sort of people were captured? From where and by whom, and where were they taken to?
Okay, well, right, that's quite a few questions.
Yes.
I mean, essentially, it's going really from about the early, from about the 15th century, but it begins to get a significant feature of English experience anyway, from the late 16th and then 17th century. These privateers from North Africa are capturing people really from throughout the Mediterranean and beyond, and the beyond bit is really where the English come in, but not all the English. A lot of the English and Scots and Irish and Welsh are captured on boats in the Mediterranean. So the majority of people who are captured are sailors who are engaged in trade in the Mediterranean. But then again, you start getting, particularly in the 17th century, as the volume of trade across the Atlantic with the English colonies becomes more significant, you get people captured travelling across the Atlantic to places like Barbados and Jamaica and the English colonies in the Americas. So that's the main source. But you do also get average men, women, and children grabbed on raids along the coast, particularly in Cornwall. And there's a famous raid, for example, in the island of Baltimore in 1631. So that's where the Britons, as it were, are captured. But obviously there's lots of other nationalities too, but mostly captured in the Mediterranean, but sometimes with raids as far afield as the Vestman Islands, which are Iceland, for example, in 1627. You get a significant chunk of that population enslaved there.
So it was quite a lot. Okay, was the 17th century the height of this experience?
The 17th century was the height of the experience, and it really begins to, it tails off towards really the beginning of the 18th century, it begins to tail off. So when you look at, for example, charities that are set up to support slaves or to provide money for redemption of slaves, those who are lucky enough to be redeemed, they really begin to run out of work in the mid-18th century. But in the 17th century, it's a very significant experience for Britons, and it's caused a lot of anxiety nationally.
And where do these people end up in North African slave markets?
Well, yes, most of them end up in North African slave markets, so in Morocco and Tunis, Algiers, these kind of key areas. Yes, that's where most of them end up, and most of them stay there. Some end up going further into the Ottoman Empire. But most end up just staying in there or in the periphery. Although in Morocco, they do go much further inland. They get used on big building projects. But mostly they hang around in the north. Well, they're held in the North African ports.
And how much do we know about the experience of these people? Do we have much testimony from them?
Yes, we do. We have quite a few accounts. Of course, these accounts are quite interesting because they're very much filtered through the kind of expectations of the readers at the time, as it were. So a lot of the accounts are rather similar. Some of them even are kind of plagiarized. But we do have first-hand accounts that are published, but we also have first-hand accounts through letters, for example. It was quite a popular form of literature at the time. They were really kind of the precursor to the novel, I think, in many ways, in English as well, emerging at the same time as you really begin to get novels emerging in English culture. So these things were very popular reads, quite exciting, but also quite terrifying, of course. That's part of the appeal.
And presumably it was a very unpleasant experience for those cultures.
Well, it varied. It was unpleasant. I mean, a big debate is just how unpleasant was it, because, of course, of the much more kind of morally significant enslavement of Africans who ended up in the Americas. There's quite a debate even quite early on about, was this really the same? Were these people really, they experienced the same kind of hopeless slavery and appalling conditions that Africans experienced? And for some, definitely. I mean, the ones I particularly focused at, because I've done a kind of almost kind of micro-historical study of a particular group, of the slaves. They, for the most part, many were put to death, many just were worked to death, many just died of neglect, but a few were redeemed. There was always the unusual thing relative to, for example, African slavery, was that a few were capable of being ransomed, that they were kind of worth, rather like modern pirates, as it were. If you try to hang on to somebody, they could be worth more alive than dead, and more alive than sort of worked to death, as it were. So there were always a few that were capable of being ransomed.
Yeah, so that's unique to this aspect of the story, then, is it? Because that never happens with African slaves.
Well, no, it doesn't happen with African slaves. So it is different. Mm. But at the time, the actual slaves themselves, some of them distinguish between their experience. Some have absolutely horrific experiences, and some say, "Well, actually, mine wasn't so bad. You know, I was bought by a very nice man or something like that, and, you know, made to feel part of the family," which sounds a bit odd. But if they had a particular skill, and a lot of the people owning them weren't necessarily that wealthy or ruthless or anything like that, they were perhaps a farmer who needed another farmhand, and so they could sometimes they even get married off to relatives, but they are very much, you know, they're not the typical experience, but they do show the variety of experience that people could have.
So how does this tie into the broader story of slavery then? Because you mentioned to me when we were discussing this before that the first collective statement made in support of abolition of slavery came in 1688 in America, but it wasn't talking about African slaves. It was talking about those enslaved in the story we're talking about.
Well, not exactly, actually. The statement itself was against African slavery, but right. What was unusual about it was, so it's the first collective statement against slavery, certainly in Western society, and it's done by a bunch of Christians in Pennsylvania, Germantown, Pennsylvania, recent immigrants to Pennsylvania. And why I'd mentioned it was, what's unusual is the grounds on which slavery is opposed. And one of the things that's overlooked is that the beginning of this statement is a call to the reader to imagine what it would be like if you were enslaved. But what's different about that kind of ethical idea in this letter is, it says, imagine if you were captured by the Turks. And what's interesting is that the people in 1688 who wrote that declaration were at the time raising money to try to ransom, to redeem free fellow co-religionists who were themselves enslaved in Algiers and then Morocco. So what's, I think, striking about it is the first kind of statement against for the abolition of slavery comes from a group of people who are themselves, they know and experience, or within their extended kind of network, they know people who are enslaved. So it's not a kind of theoretical thing, imagine what it's like to be a slave. It's something that was actually quite a kind of a reality for these people as a possibility. Even some of the people who'd helped ship them over to Pennsylvania were themselves, have been then subsequently been captured and enslaved in North Africa. So
did it continue to inform those abolition debates subsequent to that?
No, it does in an indirect way. That you do get people trying to criticise when they're making a kind of religious argument for the abolition of slavery, and obviously in the Western context that was based on Christian language, that they would often say, well, it's often trying to shame the slaveholders by saying, well, actually the Turks treat their slaves much better than you treat yours, and you call yourself a Christian, you know. So so in that sense it does. But actually the Germantown Declaration 1688 is interestingly historically as the first statement, but it goes nowhere. You know, you really don't get significant movements of the abolition of slavery emerging till later in the 18th century. But it's an interesting document, and in the period it appears is a striking one because of this European experience of slavery that was going on in the 17th century. So so that's why it's, you know, of note. But I'm afraid, tragically, anybody looking at the history of the abolition of slavery realizes that 1688 turns out to be a bit of a dead end. It's important in this kind of sentiment, but it's not important for any practical purposes.
So it's interesting that they were sort of talking about slavery in comparative terms, in the sense of looking after slaves better in one place than another.
Oh yes, definitely. I mean, some of the critics would often say this, and in later, in fact, in the 18th century, they would do this. And when you look at the publication of accounts of slaves in the 17th century that start occurring, later, because they become a kind of they are a kind of perennial interest. But in the 18th century, you get them being reprinted, and people have a renewed interest in them. It's partly for on those kind of grounds, really, that yes, they're horrible stories, but they are used by abolitionists to sort of try and shame the Christendom, as it were, into that it should at least behave as well as, if not better than, these non-Christians. So,
what other social implications of this slavery business going on with Europeans were there in the 17th century? How else did it affect society?
Well, it affected society in all kinds of ways. I think sometimes in quite surprising ways. Namil Mata, who's really one of the absolute key kind of experts on this, makes some very interesting points. That if you look at the role of women in politics in the 17th century, you get, for example, in the 1620s onwards, these really interesting phenomenon of women who are left behind, as it were, when their men are captured. And a lot of the men captured are, said, sailors or perhaps fishermen, who are just captured because they're out at sea a little bit off the coast. Then, of course, they leave behind families that are destitute because they've lost their breadwinners. So you see them cropping up on their kind of parish charity accounts. But the really interesting thing that Professor Massa noticed was that really from 1620s onwards, you start getting large numbers of women signing petitions and petitioning government and really... very doggedly demanding that ransoms be raised, nationally to pay for the freedom of their menfolk, because they are so destitute as a consequence of loss of thousands of these people. Because although the Britons were only a minority, certainly in places like Cornwall and whatever, there was a significant effect on local populations of losing these kinds of figures, sailors and fishermen who provided income. So it did become quite a national scandal, but the role of these women was very interesting. There's also one other, I think, surprising fact, which on the kind of micro study I've done of Quaker slaves, because of the 1688 document was by Quakers, so I got quite interested in Quakers who were enslaved, is that rather kind of paradoxically, the Quakers enslaved in North Africa did have, at least the ones in Algiers, had freedom of religion that at the time was denied them back in England. So you get Quakers in England writing saying, well, I know you're slaves, but you're sort of better off than we are, because at least you can have your Quaker meetings, whereas we can't, which is a bit of a paradox, really.
That's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. And they then use this in their own literature, arguing for toleration and freedom for them and for others, of course, because, for example, Pennsylvania was very much founded with the expectation that all kinds of religious groups could be happy there, and it's founded by William Penn, the leading Quaker. But they use this example of freedom under the Turks, even as slaves, as something, again, to try and shame those who denied them freedom back in England and in the English colonies.
And did that have any impact with that?
Well, as a tactic, it's difficult to know if they had a tactic. Eventually, they did get more freedom. But it's interesting that this kind of Turkish religious freedom was used. I mean, it was just one argument amongst many. But it was very interesting. Having said that, the slaves themselves may have had religious freedom, but they had a rather high mortality rate, because a lot of them didn't make it because they were abused. And in fact, despite the religious freedom, some of the Quaker eccentricities released from those outside, like, for example, not taking your hat off to anybody because of just kind of radical egalitarianism, actually resulted in some of the Quaker slaves in North Africa being beheaded. So it wasn't always the freedom wasn't always quite as liberal as we might assume.
Right. Okay, in conclusion, how does this story end? How does the slave trade peter out?
Well, the slave trade really peters out, I think, with the growing military strength or naval strength of British forces. But really, the generally, it's with the just growth of the empire, so that the Barbary pirates find it, privateers find it much harder to actually roam free, as it were, across the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. Yes, I mean, that's an important conclusion. I'd say there's one or two other things that are maybe worth mentioning, if that's possible in this context, which I think one of the things that now makes it a story that's so interesting is the way in which these privateers aren't quite what they necessarily appear to be. They're often talked about as Turks or talked about as Moors. And many of them, I suppose, ethnically would be. But the term Turk in the 17th, 18th century didn't mean somebody from Turkey. It meant anybody who behaved, adopted the dress, customs and religion of the Turks. And actually, a lot of the privateers were not from the Mediterranean at all. They were from Europe. So they were Turks, but they were in fact Dutch or English people, some of whom were converts to Islam, but many of whom were not. They didn't necessarily have to be. So when they had ended up in North Africa, they or they'd often say chosen North Africa or ended up there because they'd been captured themselves, they made it a base, as it were, for being a private. So there was a very multinational kind of fleets. So I think that's quite important in this story, because it's often, particularly at the moment, people tend to think rather sort of simplistically about sort of the West and the kind of Islamic empires and all this sort of thing. And actually, this story is a far more complex one. I mean, one of the leading privateers, for example, is somebody called Jack Ward, who was an Englishman who was based in Tunis and ended up really running the show in Tunis as a privateer, or again a Dutchman, the one who sacked Baltimore. Jan Janssen, who was he was Dutch, but became an absolutely key privateer. So that's another part of the story, as it were. It's a complex story about identity and religion and ethnicity and that sort of thing.
Lastly, can you identify any particular legacy for this period? Is there any ongoing significance to what happened there?
I think that it is something which people look at. It has a modern legacy in a number of countries. People are only becoming aware of it. I mean, it has a very specific historical legacy. I'll say in Britain, it's not very well known, unless you're from Cornwall or whatever, where you may see, for example, there are memorials in churches to people who, captured or fought back or something like that. But in the rest of Britain, perhaps not so well known. But there is a very distinctive legacy in some places. I mean, in Iceland, still is very much part of their national identity, these raids that they lost their population. I think in the kind of the contemporary world of the contemporary political world, this story is one that has a lot of uses and misuses. I think you'll find it's a very controversial area of study. There's some great scholars like Nabil Matta and Robert Davis, for example, producing some really well-informed and very important work. I mean, Nabil Matta's work, for example, also looks at Arabic sources, looks from the other side, that a lot of people in North Africa were terrified of Europeans coming and stealing them, enslaving them, because one of the key ways of getting people out of slavery was to swap them. So, you know, they were always very anxious about being enslaved. And I hope, you know, it's an area which I think people will see a lot more of. This story will become much more prominent. But I hope the work of people like Matta and Davis is the work that people turn to, and perhaps my own contribution, because there's some rather generalising sort of uses of this story, which kind of use rather simple religious sort of definitions and think about it all as a matter of war between sort of different fundamental religious kind of identities. And it wasn't. I mean, when you get down to the details, it was often, for example, the different bits in North Africa are often at war with each other. European states were at war with each other, so they were making alliances and swapping flags and religious identities all over the place. but it is a really interesting period in history, and of course it's quite, in one sense, quite rightly eclipsed by the study of the African slave trade by Europeans, but it shouldn't be forgotten. And so I'm glad it's coming back into view, but I hope it's going to come back into view much more kind of responsibly than perhaps some of the more generalised literature that's out there at the moment.
That was Cambridge University's Dr. Justin Meggett. He will be speaking on this subject as part of the Cambridge Festival Ideas on the 30th of October at Madingley Hall in Cambridge. Go to the website cam.ac.uk/festival of ideas for more information on that. Dr. Meggett's next publication is Quakers and Muslims in the 17th Century, which will be publishing early in 2012. So that's the end of it for this week. Please do get in touch if you have any comments on the podcast, particularly if you have any ideas about how we can make it better. Email us podcast@historyextra.com or contact us at twitter.com/historyextra or facebook.com/historyextra. Next week, we'll be discussing the curiously unheralded late 18th century naval battle known as the Glorious 1st of June. I do very much hope that you'll tune in to listen to that.